Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Judge Samuel Alito is being questioned about a variety of issues today as the Senate Judiciary Committee holds the second day of his Supreme Court confirmation hearings. We're going to listen in on some of the questioning and talk with Christian Science Monitor congressional correspondent Gail Chadwick, who's covering these hearings. First, Senate Judiciary Committee Chair Republican Arlen Specter began today's questioning. He asked about Judge Alito's now infamous 1985 memo written when he worked in the Reagan Justice Department and argued that the Constitution did not protect a woman's right to abortion. Senator Specter, who's an abortion rights supporter, asked Alito whether the courts should adhere to past rulings in controversial cases, what's known as stare decisis.
So let me come now to the statement you made in 1985, that the Constitution does not provide a basis for a woman's right to an abortion. Do you agree with that statement today, Judge Alito?
Well, that was a correct statement of what I thought in 1985 from my vantage point in 1985, and that was as a line attorney in the Department of Justice in the Reagan administration. Today, if the issue were to come before me, if I am fortunate enough to be confirmed and the issue were to come before me, the first question would be the question that we've been discussing, and that's the issue of stare decisis. And if the analysis were to get beyond that point, then I would approach the question with an open mind, and I would listen to the arguments.
So you would approach it with an open mind, notwithstanding your 1985 statement?
Absolutely, Senator.
And Gail Chadwick joins us now. Gail, how significant is Senator Specter's question?
For many senators, it's the heart of what this confirmation is about. It's the base, could be the basis of a filibuster. And what Judge Alito tried to do in his responses is get as close as he could to what Judge Roberts had done. Right. In effect, say he agreed that the Constitution protects the right to privacy, as every judge since Judge Bork has agreed. And that he also said that the more precedent affirms a principle, the stronger it becomes. But he did not, when pushed, agree that Roe constituted, or Casey constituted, a super precedent, or as Chairman Specter has said, a super-duper precedent, which means it's so settled in law. It's been reaffirmed 38 times. That it makes no sense for a court to go back and look at the founding principles again. And here, twice, Judge Alito said that he did not accept the idea of super precedents, and he didn't want to leave the impression that stare decisis is an inexorable command, because he said the Supreme Court says it's not. So he's really put himself right at the edge of this question.
Mm-hmm.
He said what he needs to say to reassure some people. However, he has not gone as far as Specter and those who wish to protect abortion rights would like to see, which is to agree to that it's so settled in precedent and culture that it makes no sense for a court to go back and revisit it. That he did not agree to. Mm.
Another predominant issue at today's hearing so far has been that of executive power. Senator Patrick Leahy specifically asked Alito about President Bush's decision to authorize the wiretapping of Americans and bypassing the Federal Intelligence Services Court.
Do you believe the president can circumvent the FISA law and bypass the FISA court to conduct warrantless spying on Americans?
And Judge Alito responded first by saying that this question is likely to come before the Supreme Court, and then he gave a somewhat noncommittal answer.
There may be statutory issues involved, the meaning of the provision of FISA that you mentioned, the meaning certainly of the authorization for the use of military force, and those would have to be resolved. And in order to resolve them, I would have to know the arguments that are made by the contending parties.
Gail, this was a fairly consistent response on Alito's part to several questions. What do you think we can take from that?
Not much. I mean, this will be raised repeatedly, not just this question of the FISA court, but also the general question of how much authority does the president have, and can Congress counter it? One of the themes that's come up repeatedly in questioning this morning refers back to one of the tough stands Congress did take against the Bush White House when they, the Senate especially, overwhelmingly voted to forbid torture of detainees. The president said he would threaten any bill that included that feature and in the end back down, but then quietly added a signing statement to the bill that in effect said, yes, Congress has ruled that the president can't authorize torture. However, under my capacity as commander-in-chief, if I feel it's necessary, I will, and I will also give immunity to anyone under me that tortures. Now, this really set both Republicans and Democrats on edge. So you'll see a lot of aggressive questioning on this, especially since Judge Alito, when he was a line official in the Justice Department, was part of a working group that recommended this as a strategy, that presidents should do much more with signing statements to put their stamp on what a law means.
Right, so a continuing issue throughout the hearings then.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. What about, just briefly, Gail, we heard about Alito's membership in a conservative alumni group at Princeton that opposed the admission of women and minorities in college. Big issue?
Concerned alumni at Princeton. It is actually, because it speaks to character. And in the end, what confirmation hearings about are whether people are comfortable with how a judge might act on the bench. Are they a reasonable being? And to see, you know, the son of first-generation immigrants associated with a group that was so conspicuously opposed to minorities, women, and generally mean-spirited. In effect, what he said was, I don't really remember being part of this group.
Okay, Gail, we have to stop right there. Thanks for being with us. Gail Chadwick, correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. She's covering the Judge Alito hearings. Thank you, Gail.
You're welcome.
A 28-year-old American woman who went to the Middle East to pursue her dream of becoming a foreign correspondent has been kidnapped in Iraq. Jill Carroll was abducted on Saturday in Baghdad. Her driver was able to escape and call authorities, but her 32-year-old translator was killed. Carroll is a freelance journalist reporting mainly for the Boston-based Christian Science Monitor, but she also reported for Here and Now last April, and she's widely respected for her knowledge of the area. More than 30 journalists have been kidnapped in Iraq since the U.S. occupation began, but Carroll is the first American female reporter to be abducted. For more on this story, we turn to Ellen Nickmeyer. She's Baghdad bureau chief for the Washington Post. And Ellen, can you tell us what you've learned about the kidnapping?
Jill and her translator and the driver were going to speak to a Sunni leader. They thought they had an interview set up on Saturday morning to speak to a Sunni political leader. They went there. They were kept waiting for a few minutes, and then they left. And as they left, they were just driving away from the house and armed men without masks, just normal men in street clothes, just stopped the car and pulled the driver out and drove off with Jill and with the translator. And the translator, his body was found on the street or on a sidewalk close to there.
And at this point, no one has claimed responsibility for the kidnapping? Are there negotiations going on? I mean, what's happening?
There's no one's claimed responsibility, which can be a good thing. Lots of times in these kidnappings, the first public confirmation is there'll be a video coming out on the third or fourth day of someone who has possession, and the next couple of days will tell a lot. I mean, if nothing happens, if there's no such video, that could be good news or bad news. I know that there's lots of stuff going on, efforts and negotiations and investigations.
We understand that there was a raid by the U.S. At a mosque in Baghdad, which is near where this abduction took place and is also headquarters of the Association of Muslim Scholars. What's that neighborhood and that area like where the abduction occurred, and what happened as a result of that raid at this point? Do we know?
I know that some people were taken into detention by the Americans with that raid. I don't know if everyone has been released yet. The Muslim Scholars Association head said he doesn't see any connection in between the kidnapping and that raid. And the U.S. military is saying only that that raid was in connection with a terrorist incident. They're not publicly linking the raid and the kidnapping yet. The neighborhood, it's one of the tougher neighborhoods. I went there yesterday, and the street where the kidnapping happened, the only men I saw were like a big group of men on the other side of the street, and they looked like, to me, like they weren't just, it wasn't an ordinary group of men standing around. It was a group of men there for purposes. And we saw a convoy of men in just unmarked cars driving around with Glocks and AK-47s. And it was unusual that they weren't marked cars and they weren't in uniform. Mm-hmm. There's lots of armed men, and it's a neighborhood that's seen as very sympathetic to the insurgency and just.
So I'm wondering, I read that when Jill traveled through that area, she did not have an armored car and some of the other had not taken some of the other security precautions that other journalists have done. When you are in that area, what kind of security precautions do you take?
I can't tell you that, but I can say that Jill adopted a very low-profile approach to security. There's some people who think the safest thing is to go out with an armed convoy with a bunch of guys armed with AK-47s and armored cars, sirens, and everything else. And there's other people who think, like Jill does, that the best thing is just wear a headscarf and look like an Iraqi and be as innocuous as possible, and people won't pick you out. She went very low profile. Lots of people here go kind of in between those two approaches.
And she spoke Arabic and actually apparently wrote in a fellowship application that she thought that was critical to being able to get at some of the stories that she felt were not being reported from Iraq. Do you think this will help her?
I think it will. I mean, Jill is, I mean, she cares a whole lot about Iraq. And lots of people come here and they blow through here and they don't learn about the culture and they can't speak to Iraqi. They don't know the language of the people they're covering. I mean, Jill took the trouble to learn Arabic and Iraqi Arabic, and she cared a lot about it. And she's a very charming person. She's very likable. And the fact that she cares about the story, she cares about Iraq, she cared enough to learn Arabic, and she's likable, and she's a woman. I mean, all her colleagues are hoping this all works in her favor.
So you must have been very surprised, really shocked when you heard this.
Yeah, there's so many incidents here where things happening, you just don't believe it. I mean, people disappear out of your lives, and we can't believe that it happened to Jill, and we hope, you know, that it works out for the best.
Do you think this seeming lawlessness in Baghdad and these things that happen, does it make it more difficult for you to do your job?
It does make it very difficult, and it's very frustrating. I mean, we're trying to tell the story of all sides, we're trying to tell the story of the Iraqi people. And when we have to think twice about going out on the street or going into a home or staying in a neighborhood long enough to really get to know someone, I mean, that only complicates our efforts to tell those sides of the story. And that's why this war is a little bit different from other wars I've covered.
Are you afraid?
I'm not afraid. You get used to it. A lot of the people want to do as much as they can to keep going out and covering the story. And, you know, if this were to keep happening, I mean, our fear would be that this is like a re-intensification of attacks on journalists.
Ellen, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Yeah, you're welcome, Ellen.
Ellen Nickmeyer is Baghdad Bureau Chief for The Washington Post. When we come back, we talk with one of Jill Carroll's journalism professors. Stay with us. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Deborah Becker. It's Here and Now. We've been talking about the kidnapping of American journalist Jill Carroll. She's a 28-year-old freelance reporter who works primarily for the Christian Science Monitor. She was abducted at gunpoint in Iraq on Saturday, and her 32-year-old translator was killed. Not too long ago, Jill Carroll was a student. She graduated from the University of Massachusetts in 1999, and Karen List, who's chair of the journalism department there, was one of her teachers. Karen, can you tell me about Jill as a young reporter? What were her aspirations when she was an undergraduate?
Jill actually let me know on the very first day of class what she wanted to do, and that's pretty rare. I always ask my students on the first day what their career goals are, and Jill wanted to be a foreign correspondent, and she knew that, and that's exactly what she's done.
So have you been following her career since she left?
Yes, I have, and I've kept in touch with her, as I do with many of my students. I think that Jill knew. She had a short job at the Wall Street Journal, and when that ended, she obviously could have gotten a job at perhaps a smaller paper on a permanent basis, but she knew that small paper would not send her to Iraq, and that's what she wanted to do, so she went on her own, and I just have the greatest admiration for that. She had a real passion, even as a student, for telling the difficult story. That's what she wanted to do. And so she has managed to do that.
Mm-hmm. You must have worried about her quite a bit as you followed her career.
I absolutely did. Mm. I met Jill's mom at graduation, and I think of her so often, and often wondered how she managed to cope knowing that Jill was over there. And my thoughts are certainly with her right now.
How do you think someone so young knew what she wanted to do and was so right about it?
You know, some people just have that fire and that passion for journalism, and she's one of them. She's a reporter through and through, and always will be. And again, I think that she saw this as her opportunity to develop that capacity. She saw this as her opportunity to really go someplace that people without a voice could be reflected in her work, and that is exactly what she's done. And in addition to that, even as a student reporter, she had a real knack for holding the powerful accountable. And there's a lot of that needs to be done in Iraq, too. And I think that she has done a fabulous job on both those counts.
When was the last time you heard from her?
Actually, it was shortly before Christmas, because she and I had been talking about her coming back to speak to the students at UMass. And I felt very strongly that she'd be just a tremendous inspiration to them. And she had agreed to do it, so shortly before the holidays, we'd begun talking about when she might be able to get back, and that was the last time that I'd heard from her.
Had she spoken at all about increasing violence there or any sense of being in danger?
No, not at all. And in fact, I've been on email with many of our other students who have stayed close to Jill, and a number of them have said that if they raised that question with her, she always tended to say, I feel like I know what I'm doing. I feel safe. I don't think it's a problem. But she and I had not personally talked about that.
Karen List, chairman of the journalism department at UMass Amherst, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
We now want to take a look at how the dangers of being a journalist in a war zone can make it increasingly difficult to report from Iraq. Joel Campagna is Middle East coordinator for the Committee to Protect Journalists, and he joins us on the line from New York. Joel, how dangerous is it for journalists to work in Iraq right now?
Well, it is, by our estimation, the most dangerous place in the world to work as a journalist right now. And I think journalists there today face myriad risks, from abduction, as we saw in the case of Jill Carroll, to suicide bombings, car bombings, gunfire. Those are part of the daily risks that journalists face in trying to bring this story to the world. Oftentimes when you look at the whole of the conflict in Iraq, you ask, why would journalists want to go to such a dangerous place fraught with so many risks? And I don't know the answer to that, but certainly I'm glad that they are doing this and keeping us, the public, informed.
Just last week, your group released numbers of journalists killed in the past year, 47 journalists, a number which has nearly doubled in the past decade. Why are some of the reasons for that, do you think? How do we better protect journalists from these kinds of things?
Well, I think one way is to take precautions to prepare oneself when covering a dangerous assignment. Certainly, there's no way to 100% guarantee one's safety when working in a conflict zone, and I think the aim is to mitigate risk as much as possible, and that means ensuring that journalists are as prepared as possible when going into conflict zones. That means making sure they have the appropriate safety equipment, making sure that they are not taking unnecessary risks when covering an assignment. Many news organizations in recent years have had their correspondents take hostile environment training courses as a way to prepare themselves for going to places like Iraq or other conflict zones. And many journalists say that these are helpful, but certainly no course in hostile environment training is going to prevent prevent anyone from running into problems when working in one of these assignments.
In Jill Carroll's case, though, appropriate safety equipment and hostile environment training, because she was a freelance journalist, were unlikely. And many news organizations are cutting back, particularly in their overseas coverage, and they rely on freelancers to do this who may not have the resources to do some of these things. So how do we balance that?
You know, it's a tough question, and I think it is, you know, again, it speaks to the problems that freelancers have in reporting from places like Iraq. And I think because of that risk, we've seen less and less freelancers covering Iraq. But, you know, certainly it is important for news organizations to, you know, ensure that, you know, stringers or local staff, Iraqi journalists, the many Iraqi journalists who work on the front lines for these news organizations as essential news gatherers, that you know, they are provided with you know, the means that they need to carry out their job safely.
Joel, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Joel Campagna is Middle East Coordinator for the Committee to Protect Journalists. He spoke with us from his office in New York. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Across the country, an increasing number of public schools are testing students for drugs. Over the past 2 years, the number of schools with drug testing programs has tripled, as has the federal grant money available for such testing. In the city of New Bedford, Massachusetts, parents of middle and high school students are receiving letters offering incentives if their children participate in a random drug testing program starting there this spring. We're joined on the line by Carl Alves. He's a substance abuse counselor and coordinator of New Bedford's new school drug testing program. Mr. Alves, how will this new program work?
The program is a voluntary program where parents and families will sign up their children to participate. They're informed through an orientation process, and then their children will be put into a lottery or randomization system, and their names will be pulled out. They'll be discreetly notified during the school day. Tests will be performed. The test sample will be taken to a professional lab where it will be tested, and the results will be given to a clinical coordinator who will contact the parents directly, both by phone and by letter. At that time, should the child need services, services would be offered. Should the test be negative, a congratulations will be provided to the parents and the student as well.
Do the schools find out the names of the students?
They do not. Part of the design of this program, with it being voluntary, is that we are trying to separate it from the schools and law enforcement. Law enforcement and the schools will not be privy to any of the direct information. The only people that will be notified of any test results will be the parents and the child.
When you say services will be offered, who pays for them?
The assessment and some ongoing case management and follow-up will be provided by the grant funds and through the clinical coordination. The further treatment, should a child need extensive treatment, we would help navigate that system. That would be paid for by private insurance or other means. I mean, we want to make sure that the young people, if they need help, will get the help that they need.
I guess what might be concerning for some folks is the services beyond initial assessment of the extent of a substance abuse problem really aren't guaranteed in this program.
They aren't guaranteed, but they're pretty much assured. We're fortunate in Massachusetts that there, for children under the age of 18, there are a myriad of different resources available. And by working with a professional in the field, I am certain that we'll be able to provide different levels of treatment for any student that needs help.
Why did you decide to do this? Is it because you feel that New Bedford has a particular problem with young people and substance abuse?
I think our problems are very comparable to other parts of the state and country. We're looking at 35% of ninth graders report using marijuana in the ninth grade.
Do we know yet if these types of drug testing programs actually help reduce those numbers?
We've seen some very positive results in other national programs. Our program is a little bit different with being voluntary and such. I am, however, very confident that the design of our program will lend itself well to creating more resources for young people so that we can address this issue sooner than later.
When you say voluntary, you mean the parents volunteer?
Parents volunteer. Keep in mind that all the young people that are involved in this program are under 18 and are the responsibility of their parents. We're not trying to take on responsibility of families. What we're trying to do is empower families to have the information that they need and the support they need to make good choices for their children.
Can a child refuse?
Child can refuse. We're not an enforcement agency. Should a child refuse a test, we will report the refusal to the parent.
This obviously raises civil liberties issues. How do you think that this program is designed to address some of those concerns about protecting the civil liberties of the families and the students involved? Is the anonymity one of them?
Well, I mean, the civil liberties would mean that there was no choice in the matter. This is a voluntary program. No one is being compelled to participate. If you freely choose to participate, then, you know, these are the rules. One of the benefits of this program is it's not going on a school record, it's not going on a police record, and it's not going on a Medical Information Bureau record. If you had gone to your pediatrician, that would be recorded.
What do you think, if I was a parent in New Bedford, what's my incentive to get involved and to volunteer my child for this?
It's a proactive approach to addressing substance abuse, sending a clear message to your child that, you know, substance abuse is unacceptable. In addition to that, we are working with businesses throughout the area to create various incentives for the young people, discounts at stores, movie tickets, those kinds of things, so that as an incentive as being part of this program, you're eligible to receive some of these benefits.
Carl Alves, coordinator for a new school drug testing program in New Bedford, Massachusetts. Thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
We're joined on the line now by Melissa Gilbarg. She's director of the Coalition Against Poverty in New Bedford, Massachusetts. Melissa, you have a child in the New Bedford school system. How old is she?
She's 10. She's in the fifth grade.
So not exactly testing age yet. When she gets a little older, do you think you'll ever test it?
No, I definitely will not.
Why is that?
I don't think that it's the appropriate thing to do. Testing doesn't belong in the schools. I think she would be labeled, and I understand they say, you know, the testing is going to be confidential and no one will find out about it, but when students start getting called down to the nurse's office or to this office and other students and teachers know that the testing is being done, there's going to be an automatic assumption about what kids are going down there for, and I would never want that label put on my daughter. It's something that should be dealt with in the home. I think that there needs to be education and counseling done. I definitely think drug use is a problem. However, I think when you start, kids know they're going to be tested, they are going to be more likely to not go to school. There's a huge trust issue between, you know, youth and adults, and I think that just makes the trust issue a lot bigger.
What's a better way to address the issue of substance abuse and a high rate of substance abuse that you say is a problem?
I think there needs to be more education. There needs to be more treatment. You know, we're talking about testing kids when there are like no youth beds around for kids to get into treatment centers. So if a student is identified as having a drug problem, where do they go? It's, you know, they said that some counseling will be paid for and then it'll be turned over to third-party billing. A lot of kids don't have health insurance. A lot of families don't have health insurance. We know that's a huge problem in Massachusetts. So what's going to happen when that's turned over to third-party billing and the counseling can't continue? So I think we need to put more resources into treatment and education and more peer counseling.
What about the incentives that they talked about that may entice people or change people's minds? Movie tickets, discounts in New Bedford businesses. Do you think that's going to convince anybody?
I don't, because I think that if kids are using drugs, they're not going to want to, you know, they're obviously not going to want to be tested for drugs. And offering them discounts to stores and movies and stuff does not take care of the problem that, you know, there's a lot of deeper issues that go into drug use, and discounts to stores and movie tickets don't deal with the problems that the kids are facing and why they started using drugs in the first place. I mean, I think it might work for kids who aren't using drugs just so they can get the discounts. It definitely will not work for kids who are using drugs, because there's a lot more going on than, you know, getting a free movie ticket.
Melissa, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Okay, no problem. Thank you.
Melissa Gilbarg is director of the Coalition Against Poverty in New Bedford, Massachusetts. Still to come, comedian and actor Albert Brooks. You're listening to Here and Now. Investors are keeping an eye on the Dow Jones Industrial Average today after the index closed above the 11,000 mark yesterday, something it hasn't done in more than 4 years. It was also the fifth straight day of gains in these first days of stock market trading in 2006. And joining us on the line from New York is Michael Mandel. He's chief economist at Business Week magazine. And Michael, how important is this 11,000 mark and to whom?
Well, it has a little bit of a psychological effect for traders. Who were, of course, traumatized in the aftermath of the big stock market bust. But beyond that, it really shows that the economy is continuing to move forward, that there's strength here, because otherwise you wouldn't have the stock market continuing to rise.
Mm-hmm. And why do you think it happened now?
As opposed to last year, opposed to next year, you know, these things. What's really happened is that profits have been going up. The economy has stayed strong. The unemployment rate has stayed low. In many ways, it's a very good mix of things going on. And gradually, the stock market is reacting to that. It's a very slow process. You know, this is the last couple of years has not been a case of the stock market zooming up. It's really been a very, very, very slow climb, and then maybe even sort of a step back.
Mm-hmm. So, if the Dow isn't the only index to watch here about what's happening in the economy, what about some of the other indicators and what their activity? What does that mean?
Well, I think what you want to be looking at right now is you want to be looking at what's happening in the housing market, which is extremely important, of course, because that's what's really propped up the economy. At the same time, you want to be looking at what's happening in the tech sector, because, I mean, the tech sector was what drove growth in the 1990s, and then it's kind of been flat for a while. I really think that if we're looking forward through the rest of 2006, that the main force that's going to be driving the economy is technology investment, and the main force that's going to be driving the stock market is the tech stocks.
Mm-hmm. And so can you tell me, when we hear different numbers and different predictions from economists, what does this say about the Dow as an indicator, do you think?
You know, if you're a stock market investor, you want to keep an eye on things like the Dow and the S&P, because that's really what's going to be telling you how you're doing. If you're an ordinary person right now, what you care about more is you care more about the unemployment rate, you care about what's happening to housing, and you care about what's happening in technology, because that's going to tell you just how prosperous you're going to be over the next year.
Mm-hmm. And this surge in the Dow and you know, a seemingly strong, slowly growing economy, do you think that we're going to sustain this?
We're going to sustain this. We may even do much better in 2006. You know, the last couple of years you call it a surge in the Dow. The fact is that we're sort of just a little bit above where we were in 2004, and we're sort of slowly kind of climbing up. I think that 2006 is all in all going to be a good year.
So am I hearing that you think we might get close to 2001 levels anytime soon?
Well, I think that we're getting very close on the sort of the Dow to getting back to where we were in 2000. The real interesting question is what's going to happen to technology stocks. Are they ever going to get back to where they were? Certainly some of the real high flyers never will. But, you know, there's so much ferment going on in the Internet at this point and in telecom that, you know, this could be a very good year for technology.
Mm-hmm. And how will the midterm elections affect what's happening in the economy?
The midterm elections aren't going to have any effect on the economy whatsoever. The big forces on the economy have much more to do with can people keep spending, can businesses start spending, and really is the global economy going to stay strong?
I hear you say that you think the economy is moving forward, and you think that 2006 is going to be strong. Somewhat measured, though. Are your predictions somewhat measured at this point,
or are you because housing has? I think we're going to actually see a fairly I've gone on record as predicting that the housing bust may finally be upon us. I would actually think that's going to be a pretty use a technical term, it's going to be a pretty yucky year for housing.
Thanks for that technical term. Michael Mandel, chief economist at Business Week magazine. Thanks for being with us.
Right.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Deborah Becker. It's Here and Now. Bridging the cultural differences between the United States and countries with large Muslim populations doesn't exactly provide material for punchlines, but filmmaker and actor Albert Brooks is taking on this subject in his new movie, Looking for Comedy in the Muslim World. Brooks wrote and directed the film and plays the lead character, who is also a comedian named Albert Brooks, and who gets an unusual diplomatic assignment.
So, we'd like for you to head up a project. Take a month, go to India and Pakistan, write a 500-page report, and tell us what makes the Muslims laugh. You'd be doing a hell of a service for your country.
Recently, we caught up with Albert Brooks to talk about his movie, which he says was made in response to September 11th.
After 9/11, you know, the longer I thought about what I wanted to do for my next movie, I just thought, you have to do something with this subject. We all sat home, and we still do, and they're scaring everybody. And certainly the first year after 9/11, it was on a daily basis. Is it coming today? Is it coming tomorrow? You couldn't, I don't think, make a comedy in the first 18 months. It just didn't feel right. But after a while, it seems to me that, okay, what the government is saying is that this is a new world. And this world's going to be around now for a long, long time. So now you have to make comedies. It can't be a taboo subject anymore. It's the subject forever.
Sony declined to distribute this. Is it because it was sort of controversial to take a serious thing like 9/11 and make it into a comedy, or why? Do you know?
Yes, it was because of the word Muslim in the title. And by the way, they were okay with this for 5 months, and I sort of think that maybe somebody very high up sort of looked at a computer printout and said, what's this? This is a movie we're putting out? What, are you crazy? You know, it's just they're scared too. I mean, I'm not stupid. I'm not going to make a movie defaming a religion, but you can't tell me that a guy who's playing a comedian who's trying to look to see what makes people laugh is an offensive thing. It just isn't.
You know, maybe I will have a small drink. In your honor, I will have a Manhattan.
Well, I'm not from Manhattan. I'm from Los Angeles.
Oh, well, does Los Angeles have any drinks named after them?
I think they have one, the freeway.
What's that?
Well, it's like a martini. But from the time you order it, it takes 3 hours to get here.
Is that a joke?
Yeah.
Oh, see, I almost got that instantly, but I still had to ask.
Yes, but look how much better you're getting.
Do you think that comedy can cross cultures?
Well, let me tell you something. We had our world premiere of this movie at the Dubai International Film Festival, and I am here to tell you it crossed cultures in the most spectacular way I hope the movie plays in New York as well as it played in Dubai. You know, early in the movie, when I arrive overseas in India, and my wife, you know, I say maybe I've taken a bit off more than I can chew, and my wife says, everyone is so proud of you, even my mother. And I say, honey, your mother thinks a Muslim is a fabric.
Right.
I'm telling you, they laughed for half a minute. And you know, when I wrote that, I looked up, to make sure that Muslim is a worldwide word, and it is. And then, you know, I started to ask people, fabric can't be perceived as a bad word, can it? Does fabric mean something that I don't, you know, I don't know. I'm flying blind here. You know, in the scene in the beginning of the movie with Fred Thompson, where he says, you know, you're to go to India and Pakistan, and I say in that government meeting, well, I know Pakistan is a Muslim country, but I thought India was Hindus. And they say, well, there's over 150 million Muslims in India alone. Fred says, is that enough for you? They laughed for 20 seconds.
Right.
I think, first of all, people appreciated not seeing this same story where these people are portrayed as the bad guys. Mm-hmm. You know, in the movie where I have to cross into Pakistan illegally. I'm meeting these guys who want to be comedians. So, you know, it was like they appreciated that too, you know? It was really remarkable to see the similarities of, and I say it's the similarity of tension. You know, there's a teeny amount of people in the world that want to do harm, and then the majority of the world wants to, you know, get through the day and raise their kids and have a nice meal and, you know, buy a nice shirt.
Why India, though?
Well, first of all, a number of reasons. Part of this story is the conflict between India and Pakistan, and that was sort of something that's been going on for a long time, and I wanted to that was part of my story. India was a place that hasn't been seen a lot in a contemporary fashion. They, you know, a lot of movies, Passage to India and Jungle Book, you know, they do India a long time ago. The other reason is, if it was my desire to go to the places in the Middle East, currently I can't go there. I would not be invited into Syria or Iran to make a movie. You know, most movies that are claimed they make in the Middle East, they make in Morocco.
You also play Albert Brooks, right? And so how is the real Albert Brooks like the Albert Brooks in the film?
Well, I played Albert Brooks in my very first film in real life. You take elements of your brain. Maybe the real Albert is nervous about stuff a lot, you know? And so you do that. But then you sort of just use it as a comedy creation. I just like it because, as in real life, in this movie, it was the only thing. You know, if the government's going to call a comedian to come in, I'm going to play that comedian. Who am I going to play? I can't play Steve Martin. Nobody would believe it.
I'm wondering, at one point in the movie, after you do a stand-up routine, you return to stand-up in the movie, one of the folks who plays a State Department character starts taking apart your stand-up routine, and you say, look, I don't analyze comedy. If I did, I wouldn't do it.
Yeah.
And now that, I thought, was interesting because, I mean, is that an inherent problem, then, of what the whole point of the movie was trying to achieve, was finding out what was funny and sending a comedian to do it?
Yeah, you got one of the lines there. That was sort of like, you know, I'm there to do that, and I say I don't do that. The idea, by the way, of the government trying to find out anything about people other than where they live and bombing them is a very healthy one. But if you were really going to find out what made a group of people laugh, I don't think you should send a comedian anyway, because, you know, they sort of come with preconceived notions. They have comedy blinders on.
We only have one mic. You asked me to put it out front.
I know, but I need an offstage mic, because then I'm going to have to introduce myself.
So?
Well, you want to go get that mic for me?
You want me to go out and get the microphone?
Yes.
You don't want to get it?
No.
Why not?
Because I'm the headliner. I shouldn't go out and drag the mic off and then make another entrance. It's... Please.
What do you hope that audiences take from the film?
You know what? If they laugh at just in general at a subject that's been scaring them like it has me, then that's as good as I can do. And if it, you know, movies aren't going to solve the world's problems. They're not, nothing is capable of that. I just feel it relieves the tension. I think if you can go out to dinner afterwards and talk about it for an hour, I've accomplished a lot.
Filmmaker Albert Brooks, his movie, Looking for Comedy in the Muslim World, opens next week. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.